And I think the main point of this parable that we often call the parable of the prodigal son, the main point, the main emphasis is the love of God, the pardoning, accepting, receiving love of God. And it seems to me that although it's called possibly the parable of the prodigal son, actually the main character in the story is the father. And it's the father that we learn about. So in his commentary on Luke, a guy called Michael Wilcock sums this up. He sums it up like this: there is unbounded joy in the father's house when the lost son comes home. That's what he sees as the main point of the parable. And then a slightly older book called the New Bible Commentary then takes that idea and applies it like this. It says the main point of the parable is that God rejoices over the recovery of a lost sinner. And I love this next sentence. Love it. It is his pleasure to seek and save the lost. It is God's pleasure to seek and save the lost. And as I said, as you know, I always say when I stand up here and talk to you guys, the context of what we're looking at is really important in terms of how we understand it and helping us to understand it correctly. And I had never realized the context of this parable before, but it seems to me that it's really significant. And in his commentary, a chap called Leon Morris says that this parable that we're looking at today is the third of three parables of the lost. Three parables of the lost. And we're going to look at them in a moment. So it starts off with the parable of the lost sheep. It moves on to the parable of the lost coin. And then it finishes up with the one that we're looking at, which is the parable of the lost son. Or, I just want to drop this in, should that be the lost sons? Because there are two sons in this story. And I just want to drop that into your thinking for the moment. Is only one of them lost? We'll have a think. But to help us to understand the context, we're going to read a bit more of the Bible. So apologies for lots of Bible reading, but I think it's going to help us. And you will know that when Luke was written in the original Greek, it wasn't divided up into chapters and verses. Those are things that we have added to help us, so that when I say to you, let's look at this bit, we know that we're going to look at chapter 15 and verse 1 or whatever. So what we're actually going to do is, I'm just in terms of setting the context, I'm going to start by drawing our attention to the last sentence of what we call chapter 14. If you want to look at that with me, I encourage you to do so. So the last sentence of the chapter before, chapter 14, says this. This is Jesus speaking. He says, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. And then chapter 15 goes on like this. Now the tax collectors and sinners, that's in quotation marks, were all gathering round to hear him. Do you see the link there between the end of chapter 14 and the beginning of chapter 15? They were gathering round to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep. I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin. In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. And that's what precedes the parable that we're looking at today, the parable of the lost son or of the lost sons. Okay. And I just want to, just while we're there, while we look at those three parables, just want to drop in a cheeky aside today. I hope you can cope with this. I'm sure that you can. Some of the people, when they look at these three parables of the lost, see the Trinity here. So they suggest that in the first parable, what we're seeing is Jesus, the Son, acting as the Good Shepherd. You know, Jesus definitely describes himself, doesn't he, in the New Testament. He says, I am the Good Shepherd. And so some people see Jesus there in that first parable. And then in the second parable, they see the woman who's looking for the lost coin as the church. And the lamp that she lights as being the Holy Spirit, who helps the church, who provides light to the church, who guides the church. And then in the final one, as we've already commented, the parable that we're looking at today, the one of the lost sons, they see God the Father there as the main emphasis. Now, I'm not convinced, but I thought it was such an interesting idea I would share it with you. I think it might go beyond what the text actually says, but I thought it was interesting. And so I thought you wouldn't mind me sharing it with you so that you could think about it and kick it around and see what you think. But anyway, let's go back to what we're thinking about today. As I've already said, just notice that link between the final sentence of chapter 14 and the first sentence of chapter 15. So in that final sentence of 14, Jesus says, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. And then the very next verse says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering round him to hear him. Do you see that link that's there? And then Jesus tells these three parables in response to the muttering, to the grumbling, to the complaining of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Now, these were the religious people of the day. So that's how I'm probably going to refer to them as we go on, just as a shorthand, the religious people. And this is their complaint in verse 2. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. And again, just to understand the full weight of that, in the culture that Jesus was speaking to, particularly in the Jewish culture, eating with someone was really significant because it indicated acceptance and recognition. If you sat down and ate with someone, you accepted them, you recognized them, you valued them within that culture. So this, just saying that Jesus was eating with these people meant more to its audience than perhaps it would to us today. And I just got to point out, because it makes me smile, that as is so often the case, the Pharisees, of course, were right. Jesus does welcome sinners. And inadvertently, what they intended as a criticism of Jesus actually sums up his mission, sums up the gospel, sums up the good news in a nutshell. Jesus welcomes sinners. The Pharisees were right. So let's just think a moment about that first parable, the parable of the lost sheep. Again, because we've heard it so many times, it doesn't have the same impact on us that it would have had on Jesus' original hearers. Because the first parable that he tells of the lost sheep introduces his hearers to a totally new and radically different concept. It was news to them that God goes out and finds the lost, that God seeks sinners. They had never heard that before. At the time, rabbis agreed that God would welcome a sinner if they were repentant and came to him, but not that he would actually go out and look for them. Can you imagine that? If that was your mindset, how extraordinary it would be what Jesus was saying, that God actually goes out and seeks sinners rather than sort of being there waiting when they're ready to come, when they realize. And I just put a quote up on the screen from Leon Morris that says this. It is a new idea that God is a seeking God. And again, I love this last bit. I don't know why. A God who takes the initiative. A seeking God, a God who takes the initiative. And again, I want to pause there, because that challenges my notion of church. I think that is a challenge to the church. What do you think that teaches us about the emphasis of the mission of the church, with a capital C, but also applied here to us locally? There's no doubt that Jesus has called us to make disciples. And that's what we're doing here. That's what we're doing through connect groups and that kind of thing. But that process starts, it seems to me, with actively seeking the lost, not waiting for them to come to us. And you'll be familiar with this, I'm sure. William Temple, who was an Archbishop of Canterbury, said this. You may have heard this before. The church is the only society that exists for the benefit of those who are not its members. And I think it's good to be reminded of that. If God is a seeking God, then we need also, as his people, to be people who seek those that are lost, who eat with them, who welcome them, you know. Anyway, we're supposed to be looking at the parable of the lost sons. So let's just have a little look at some parts of that there. Let me just read to you verses 11 and 12. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. And I just want to notice that, because I don't think that had struck me before. I'd always thought he'd given the inheritance to the son who went off and spent it on wild living. But what it says there is that the father divided his property between the two sons. And it may not have been that unusual in that culture at that time to do that, because at that time, most wealth consisted of land and property and the things that the land could produce. So if the land could produce crops, or if the land could sustain livestock or herds or that sort of thing. So because most of people's wealth was land, elderly fathers may divide up the land between their sons, but then continue to receive the income from it. So they would give the land over to their sons, but then continue to receive the income, the produce of the land, the fruit of the land, until they passed over, until they died. So it wasn't that unusual for that to happen. But what happens next in this parable certainly was unusual. So verse 13, not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. And I once heard a preacher say that that behaviour was tantamount to the son wishing his father were dead. And someone else has said recently that it would have been less disgusting if the younger son had spat in his father's face. So that was the level of disrespect, if you like, in the culture that was being shown here. And those things would be bad enough today, you know? But let's take a minute to think about the Jewish culture that Jesus was speaking to. It was a culture that placed enormous value on honouring your parents, on honouring your father and your mother. And I just want to look at a few verses from Deuteronomy that talk about that. So you'll know this one that's up on the screen now. So Deuteronomy 5:16 says, "Honour your father and your mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that you may live long and that it may go well with you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you." And people often say that's the first command with a promise. Honour your father and mother so that it will go well with you, so that you'll live long in the promised land. But what we're probably not so keen to see is what's in Deuteronomy 27:16, which is the opposite, which is the curse, the other side of the blessing. Cursed is anyone who dishonours their father or mother. So you can see now what a big deal that would be for Jesus' hearers, for this son to be behaving so disrespectfully, to be dishonouring his father in this way. And just one final, you probably can't read that because that text is quite small, but I'm going to read it to you. Just one final passage from Deuteronomy, this time from 21 verses 18 through 21. This kind of is applying it in practice. So if someone has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother and will not listen to them when they discipline him, his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders at the gate of his town. They shall say to the elders, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of his town are to stone him to death. You must purge the evil from among you. All Israel will hear of it and be afraid. So that is an ultimate consequence there, isn't it? And I think that the religious people listening to Jesus say in this parable may well have thought that stoning to death a fitting end for this wild living son. Or at least that the father, in the son's absence, should have considered him to be dead. You know, "You're dead to me." I think the religious people, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, would have thought in their culture that that was a reasonable thing to do. And they certainly would have thought that it served the son right when he ended up feeding pigs in a foreign land. You might know that the Jews classify animals as clean and unclean, and pigs fall into the unclean category. So it really was shameful to be looking after pigs. However, thankfully, that's not where the story ends. We don't leave the young son there, do we? We don't. Let me just read to you verses 17 through to 20. "When he came to his senses..." That's a marvellous moment, isn't it? "When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father." And what I see in those verses there is repentance. You know, the son realizes the error of his ways and determines to return humbly to his father. And I'm going beyond the text now, but the way I imagine it is that on his way home, he's rehearsing this confession. "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants." And then we have the father's response, don't we? In the second part of verse 20, let me read it to you. "But while he was still a long way off..." Again, it's speculation. But was the father getting up every day and looking in the direction of that foreign land to see whether there was dust on the horizon, to see whether his son was coming back? I don't know. "But while his son was still a long way off, his father saw him. And what happened? He was filled with compassion for him, filled with grace. He ran to his son. He threw his arms around him and he kissed him." Now, it's not uncommon for men in the Middle East to kiss one another as a greeting, but I think there was more to this kiss than that. I think the fact that he ran, he threw his arms around him, tells us something about the passion of the father for the son. And again, Jesus' hearers, the people listening to him at the time, would have been astonished by the father's reaction. You may know that this was such undignified behavior for a senior person, for an elder, for a father in that culture. Respectable elderly men did not run. Not least because in that culture where you're wearing a long robe, you'd have to hitch it up in order to be able to get your legs to do the running motion. It wasn't the thing that the respectable did. It wasn't the thing that dignified people did. And did you notice in the following verses, the returning son doesn't even get to the end of his carefully rehearsed confession before the father interrupts him and showers him with gifts. Are you seeing the grace in this parable? Are you seeing the grace in the Father's heart? And each of these gifts has significance, again, in the culture. And my NIV Study Bible describes each of them as signs of position and acceptance. So let's just look at them quickly. He brings the best robe. The Father brings the best robe for the Son. And that was a sign of distinction. That best robe set him apart from others. It showed who he was. The Father calls for a ring and puts it on his finger. And the ring was a sign of authority. Some speculate that it was the family ring, the signet ring, the sign of the family. There's significance, too, to the fact that he says, get some sandals for him. Because only free men in that culture wore shoes, wore sandals. Slaves went barefoot. So there's significance there. And finally, he says, you know that fattened calf we've been looking after? The one we enter in all the shows? Go and get that and kill it. This is a special occasion. We've been breeding it for a time such as now. Let's do it. And it seems to me that each of these four things are emblems, are signs of sonship. The Father's saying, come off it. You're not going to come and work for me. You're not going to come and be my slave. You're my son. And here are the things that show. You know, the robe, the ring, the sandals, the party. And let's not overlook the party. Verse 24 says, so they began to celebrate. And I'd never noticed this before, so I'm thankful to the commentaries that I've looked at and the other sermons that I've read on this. But ironically and wonderfully, the son found the pleasure that he'd gone looking for at home with his father. The thing he was really looking for, that he travelled to distant lands and spent all his money on, was at home with his father. And the words used by the father in that verse, in verse 24, strike me as the language of salvation. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again, death to life. He was lost and is found. Okay, but I said we might call this the parable of the two sons or the parable of the lost sons. So let's just think about the older son, just for a moment. Not for too long, I promise you, but just for a moment. Just noticed, I hadn't seen this before. It's so good for me when I get to preach on this stuff because I learn so much. I hadn't noticed this before. Verse 28, the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. You know, notice that the father went out to both sons. Not just to the prodigal, but to the older son too. And again, the father debases himself. Pleading with your son was undignified. Culturally, that was not a thing that a father would do. But the older son's response gives him away. Gives him away. Verse 29. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. He's been slaving, obeying orders. He seeks to justify himself, it seems to me, by his self-righteous behavior, rather than sharing in the joy of the father that his lost brother has been welcomed home. And again, in a fantastic sentence, have I got it on the screen? No, I think this is my last slide. But in a fantastic sentence from Leon Morris's book, he says of the older son, he did not really understand what being a son means. So in conclusion, I think it's reasonable to suggest that the younger son represents the tax collectors and the sinners who wanted to know Jesus. They wanted a relationship with him, and Jesus welcomed them and ate with them. And that the older son represents the religious people, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, who were tied up with religious rules, which actually prevented them from coming to know Jesus, prevented them from entering to that relationship. Like the older son, the Pharisees were trying to earn the Father's love, whilst the sinners, like you and I, threw themselves upon the Father's grace. You know, that grace is there today. You know, the Father is looking for us. Many of us have thrown ourselves upon his grace, and we know the blessings of sonship, of daughtership, of being accepted, of being received. If you haven't done that today, if you haven't turned back to God, if you haven't come to your senses and say, look, Lord, I've messed it up. Please will you forgive me? Please will you welcome me back? You know, he's waiting to do that. And it would be my privilege and my pleasure, if you want to turn your life over to Jesus today, I would love to pray with you. So come and find me, and we'll do that. So, grace life. I hope that's whetted your appetite for what's going to come over the next few weeks.